This is interview number one with Jerry Biddle at the Port Washington Public Library. Today is December 18th, 1980. Jerry, I'd like you to begin the interview, please, by telling me a little bit about your grandmother.
Minnie Biddle. Well, as far as I know, she was a great woman, a long liver, from a long line of long livers in my family. Grandma was 102 when she died in 1970. And she was a launderer. She did laundry when she was younger for the Davises and other large farmers in Fort Washington. I remember telling me stories about some of the old farms she worked on, Townsend's and Standards and Munford's. Pretty sure it was the Munford family. She used to do laundry for them.
How old was she when she came to Port Washington?
She was born here. She was born in Port Washington in 1868. And her mother was born here in 1817, I think. Yeah, 1817, my great-grandmother was born here. And my great-grandmother died in 1946.
What was her maiden name?
My grandmother or my great-grandmother? My grandmother?
Both, yeah.
My grandmother's last name was Jenkins. My great-grandmother's name was Dumpson. Familia. Familia Dumpson. Or Phoebe. Familia.
Is she the one who was born in 1817? Familia Dumpson?
No, we're going way back here.
Right. We had gone back as far as your great-grandmother.
She died in 1919, so that must have been... She was the one born in 1817, I guess. She died in 1919. That was my grandmother's... My great-grandmother's mother.
Right.
Yeah, my great-grandmother's mother.
Okay, so that's your great-great-grandmother. Is that the farthest back person that you have heard about in Port Washington?
Yeah, I heard about was, her name was Liber Jane Townsend.
Okay, and why did she come to Port Washington? Did you hear any stories about why she was here?
I heard that... No, there's not that many stories. I think my great-great-grandmother was here. No, she wasn't. My great-great-grandfather was here. My great-great-grandmother was brought here, I think, by the Onderdonks. Well, she worked on the Onderdonk farm or something like that. It's a little... Some of the old times will have to give you that. Maybe my... aunt, my cousin Dot, we call her Ann Dot. She's got a memory like a record. She's good.
Hmm. With somebody like Liber Jane Townsend, did she work as a slave on the Onderdonk farm, or was she a freed woman?
I think she was a free woman. I'm not sure now. Maybe she came here as a houseworker. I'm not sure. But, she evidently met where the Indian ancestry goes way back. One of the workers on the Onderdonk farm or something like that married her. His first name, I don't know. Evidently, that's where the Townsend came from. You'd have to go way back in the Queen's book of records to find that out, but I understand that my great grandfather's name was Aaron Dumpson. And there's so many stories, I really couldn't break it down to who my great-great-grandfather was, great-great-great-grandfather. I know my great-great-grandmother's name was Liba Jane Townsend.
Okay. And there are no stories about any special experiences she had had in Fort Washington. When you think of her name, Liba Jane.
Liba Jane, no. They probably, you know, my father or...
Yeah, they might have stories about her.
Have stories.
Okay. So when did the Biddle name first come to be?
Well, my grandfather, William Biddle, came here in, I think around 1880s, late 1870s. He worked on a boat. Now, I think it was either a sand boat that they were coming here getting sand and taking it to, originally from South Carolina. He came here in the 1870s, and after coming here for a while, I guess he settled. He met my grandmother, and that was in the 1870s or something like that. 1880s.
How old was he when he came?
I don't know, maybe 30.
Mm-hmm. Do you know why he came to Port Washington in particular?
Well, I think it was, like I say, he was working on a boat, on a sand ship or a clam ship, I don't know. I think it was a sand barge.
Oh, so this was one of the delivery areas.
Right,
and that's how he first got here. Okay, so he came directly from South Carolina to Port Washington.
Right.
He didn't live in New York City for a while, nothing like that.
My great-grandfather, who was supposedly Aaron Dumpson, who was on a rumboat, and they jumped ship in, one of the Dumpsons, Aaron Dumpson, came to New York, and one brother was supposed to go to Philadelphia, maybe two brothers came to New York. There's some Dumpsons in New York City. James Dumpson. My cousin Bill was had made arrangements to have an appointment with James Dumpson in New York City. I don't know the outcome of that. You know, it's quite a few years back.
Right.
How the Dumpsons finally got to... well, evidently, they had to come here as slaves. Somebody came here as a slave. One of the women... Lima James, maybe one of her sisters, or I don't know, but her husband was originally from Cow Neck, and he was my grandma was telling me he was an Indian, he was a Pusputuk. That's my great great grandfather.
All right, Lima James' husband. Okay. Back to your grandma, which we started on and we should come back to. What are your earliest memories of her?
Well, she used to... When we used to go to school, I know, after we came from school, my mother was a day worker, my father worked in a garage. She used to, you know, babysit, watch for us until my mother came home from work. Or one of my oldest sister would come home and take us from grandma's home. I was born in Port Washington, you know, raised in Port Washington. I don't remember my grandfather. I always remember my mother, grandmother. She had chickens, and she used to do a lot of laundry. And my aunts used to help her with the laundry. They also did housework here on the big homes in Port Washington, the Townsends and the Coxes. The Coxes was a big family, and they also worked on the Cox family estate. They used to work for the Guggenheims. I know my uncle used to work for, because my great uncle used to work on the Davis farm. My Uncle Will, I remember him on a horse and buggy. He used to drive a team of horses for Johnny Wagner. Now, who Johnny Wagner was, I mean, maybe it was a Wagner farm in those days, but he was, I remember him driving the horse and carriage, and there was always hay on there. We always used to catch a ride from school on the horse wagon, and they used to, the Wagners had a place up by the old, I don't know if that's ABC or, it was a tower up by where the Guggenheim School is now. It used to be all farmland. It used to come from up there. We used to catch them when we was at Sands Point School, which is now John Daly School. And he used to go down towards Plandome. And I used to live down off of Mill Pond on School Street.
Is that where you were born?
That's where I was born, yeah.
Where did your grandmother live while you lived on School Street?
All her life, I guess. All I know of is on 92 Harper Road.
92 Harper Road.
92.
Okay. When you caught rides on this horse and carriage, would you date that the 20s?
Huh?
30s?
No. 40s? I was born in 1935, so put that 1941... 1942.
Okay.
Around there.
Alrighty. And how much did your grandmother get paid for the work that she did? Do you remember any stories about how much the Guggenheims paid?
You didn't talk that kind of business with old people. You never got into that. I never got into that. You, when I was coming up, you had your limits. I used to ask about my grandfather, which he. She just said your grandfather was a very staunch man, very proud man, hard worker, very hard worker. He worked on he used to do foundations for the Hydes and the Baxters. He was more or less, he had some kind of business, I don't know, some type of trucking business at one time. I know my Uncle Emmett, who was my great-grandmother's brother, he had some type of ash removal, garbage removal business back in the 20s. My grandfather had some type of excavation business going.
Who else did he work for aside from the Hydes? Did you mention something about Main Street?
Yeah, I think he dug the foundation, helped dig the foundation for the Main Street School. Hmm. In those days, I think my father told me they had mules, horses, and skid shovels. I mean, they didn't have any modern equipment, you know, excavating equipment like they have today. They did it with a type of shovel that, you know, you scooped it up and made the foundations. Hmm. I remember my father and I, we worked for, there was a German fella down in Manor Haven, Mass, and Isle, all those factories down there. I helped build about 15 of those factories down there, my father and I. I was a kid. We used to dig the footage for those buildings down in there. It was all marshland then, just getting developed. And that was in the 50s.
So would you say that there's been a long tradition of being in the construction and trucking business in your family in town?
More like builders in the construction line. But my father soon ventured out of that. My father at one time had his own gas station at the corner of the triangle between Harbor Road and Valley Road. He was there a few years. I can remember that vividly. I remember the old cars he used to have around the garage. They used to go down there and play them. I'll never forget the old Bearcat Stutz he had. Well, he was working on it. He never finished. Junked it. It's worth a lot of money today if he kept it.
Can we get back to your grandfather for a moment? When did he die?
Grandpop died in... just before I was born. I think he died in either 1935 or 34.
Okay. Do you remember why he died?
Well, from what I hear, the Depression hurt him a lot. When the banks fell in 29, I guess, the crash, he had a little bit of money up there in the bank, and it wiped him out. It supposedly wiped him out. Mm-hmm. He was a hard-working man, very hard-working man. My father was a hard-working man up until he retired. So, mostly back-breaking work, you know.
Yeah.
Constructive, back-breaking. And my grandmother, back-breaking, laundry,
yeah.
Cleaning. I remember a cousin of mine, her name was Katie Griffin. We used to call Aunt Katie. The Griffins, who were related to my grandmother's uncle. In fact, Uncle Emmett was my grandmother's uncle. Well, that would make him my great-grandmother's brother. And Uncle Emmett, he was also a hard-working man. He had some type of construction going on in the 19s and the 20s, the early teens and the 20s. He was another very proud, I used to love to hear him speak in church. Very slow then, well, he was very old when I was a child. I think Uncle Emmett died in the late 40s, I think Uncle Emmett died. He was a Griffin, which is another old family, quite an old family, Griffins, Boston's, Townsend. It goes a long way back,
What was education like for your grandparents and great-grandparents?
From what I understood was the best education, respect, very little schooling. I guess Grandma could write a name, but I don't think she could read that because she had what they used to. I used to hear my grandma and them also call mother wit. They had mother wit. They had something that was it wasn't in books, but they learned, you know, civil respect for the neighbors. My grandmother was like, she could tell stories like since we were the. One of the oldest black families here, she was telling me stories. She used to tell me stories about when the old Jewish people used to come here from Germany and wherever, and how she used to help them. And a few people ridiculed her for it. She had a Jewish family that used to stay in her barn. And she used to tell me stories about the old Italian families when they first came here. And how my grandfather used to help build some of the old homes up around Avenue A or something like that. But you know, like, you could get into a story with Grandma and then she said, well, look, son, now I have work to do. She was always baking or doing laundry. So you didn't hold them up from their work, you know. They'd always tell you to go out and play. I was always nosy, but she used to tell me some stories like about the real old days, the farm work, how my cousin William was telling me at one time about the old model boats that my two uncles, it was Uncle Will and Uncle Wal. They used to sail old model boats. They used to make their own model boats and sail them. And my cousin, Chippy, we call her, her name was Shaw, we call her Chippy. She was trying to make me remember. And then it did bring a part of my life where I do remember my Uncle Wal sailing little model ships and wearing his big hip boots. When it was so far back, and I understand that Wal and Will were some of the original model boat sailors of the early 30s. If it was around my time, it had to be the early 40s, that they were still sailing these little model ships. As far as history, we were just plain workers, you know. We didn't have much to start with, so it's not like...
Well, you mentioned the Depression wiped out your grandfather. What about the wars? World War I, World War II, did they have any effect at all?
I don't think so. We tease my father. We always tease him about that. He teased us about the trenches of Germany. He never was in the army. But we had people in the Second World War. Uncle Walter was in the Second World War. My cousin Harry Townsend was in the Second World War. My cousin Buddy Dumpster. Oh, a lot of Dumpster boys were in. My cousins were in the Second World War. Losies, they were my cousins. And my cousin Nisi, she was a WAC. My cousin George was in the Navy. A lot of people in the family were in the Second World War. We had one cousin that was in the Korean War. I had four cousins that saw action in Vietnam. I had lost one cousin in Vietnam. My brother was in Vietnam with an injury.
Did any of the old folk have any things like Civil War stories to tell? Were any of them involved in that battle?
They never talked to me about it. I guess when I was... I didn't know anything about the Civil War or anything like that. Hmm. They used to tell stories about the old Indian cemetery and things like that. They never told too many war stories.
Abolitionist activities? Underground Railroad?
No, but I remember them telling me a story about some Klansmen in Port Washington in the 30s or late 20s that visited the Zion Baptist Church one Sunday. It seems that some Klansmen came in there, whatever. And some old, different stories of some of the hard times that blacks saw in this town. I remember a story of a friend of the family who was accused of a crime. I don't know if he slapped this lady or hit her or pushed her. This was in the 40s, where he was taken to jail, and the next day he committed suicide. And you know how some of these suicides are. And that went over.
How did the black community react?
Well, they didn't like it. They knew it was a lie. He wasn't the type to... he wasn't suicidal, Very few black people are suicidal. All they have to do is live.
Survival instinct.
Survival instinct, right. They lived. They enjoyed life. None of them were suicidal.
But this is the first incident like that you remember. Was not until the 40s. There were no stories of earlier.
Maybe they can tell you. Maybe my aunts could tell you, or my father. See, all the old people, we never had, they never kept records or clippings or things like that. Maybe my cousin Gloria might have a few old stories to tell, or clippings from the early 40s, the 30s. Mm. It was a town where I grew up thinking, I never knew what the word segregation was until it hit me. That was in the late 60s, middle 60s, it was segregation, integration. I was integrated all my life. I lived on a street where there was three black families. The rest were Polish, Italian, French.
This was School Street?
Yeah, an old writer. He used to live on the end of School Street by the name of Sainsbury. Mr. Sainsbury was a very nice man. We used to go down to his house. He was he used to write a lot about the sea. He was into ships. And I remember seeing the big globe that he had in his den. And he used to tell stories of the sea. And just, you know, kids listen to stories. I mean, that was a good thing about the old days and no television, when the best teachers were the old people. They taught you a lot. They taught you respect. I never knew what it was to live in an all-black community or all, you know. I didn't know anything about cross burnings or Ku Klux Klan. I didn't learn about the Klan, I guess, until well after I was in high school. You know, I never knew about Klansmen or...
Except they told you they had broken into the Zion Church.
Yes.
Did they give details of that?
I don't know if they broke in, but they walked in one Sunday. You know, I guess my aunt could tell you about the reason for the interruption of a church service one time. I don't know.
Were they aware of who the Klan members were?
I really don't know. You know, they could tell you. I wouldn't even elaborate on it because I don't know anything about it. When I was a youngster, at that time Harbor Road was primarily a black neighborhood. I knew a lot of my kin were down there. We didn't go down there to play because we had no reason to travel up that end of town. The furthest of Harbor Road I used to go was my grandmother's house, which was on the corner of Harbor and Valley. And my aunts lived on Valley. I had some aunts that lived on Harbor Road. And, but I still didn't know of it as being a black neighborhood. I just knew they lived there, you know. There was a few white families, Polish families on Harbor Road at the time, and I think one, I know the family next door to my grandmother's name, they were Priscelli's. And we lived in a community where there were a lot of Italians. My mother learned a lot of her black her recipes from the Italians. You know, she like, oh, my mother could make some spaghetti and lasagna out of this world. And we had the Manzos and the Sellers, who are neighbors. I guess they might have taught my mother a few of the old Italian recipes and how to prepare Italian food. My mother was a hell of a cook. She prepared a lot of dinners for families in Flower Hill, Sands Point. Swedish meatballs, they used to, in rolls, she could make yeast rolls out of this world. And my mother was a hell of a baker, too. She could bake. And my grandmother, oh God, could she bake? My grandmother used to make hot cross buns every holiday season. My cousin Dave and I used to sit down and eat a panful. My grandmother was a hell of a cook. She was a hell of a good cook. And they, of course, we belonged to the church up on Mackey Avenue, with Mount Olive AME Church, with my grandfather and my uncle Emmett and the Ito family and the Griffins, and they built the original foundation of the church. My grandmother and aunt, they were, and grandpa were all church people.
What year was the church built?
Our church was built in 1919 or 1920, when the church was, the cornerstone was laid.
Was that the first church in the black community, or was Zion there already?
I think Zion might have been here. I'm not sure. You'd have to see somebody in the Johnson's family. They were an older family here in town.
Why did your relatives feel it was necessary to build another church with one already in town?
I really don't know. Well, I think my grandfather was a Methodist, and my great-grandmother and them were really, well, I think the first church here around Port Washington was Methodist. Before the Catholic Church, or the Episcopal or Lutheran Church came, I think the basic religion then was Methodist or Baptist. Baptist or Methodist. I think one of the original was Baptist. And the, which I hear they all originate from the Catholic religion. The only church that I ever attended was Methodist Church.
And then Mount Olive. So before Mount Olive?
Before Mount Olive, my grandmother used to go to the Free Church, she said, which was down on, right down from her, the, on,
by the mill,
by the mill pond. Right. Mm. Well, you see, they had church services. The white people went to church first, and then after they had their services, then the black and the Indians had their services. That was segregation there, but then who was to say, you know, they dealt with it, and they lived, you know. There was, I know of no black and white confrontations ever. It was a pretty peaceful town. It still is. You know, Port Washington has come a long way, and then they haven't gone anywhere. You know what I mean? I mean,
if your great-grandmother was alive today, do you think her opportunities would have been any different? How would she
today,
have lived? Yeah, I mean, how would life have been different for
education?
Her?
Well, I'm pretty sure that my uncles and my father and my grandfather would have conducted their businesses a little more better. My father had a hell of a gas station business, which... he was one of the most popular and well-known mechanics in town. He had a gas station which fell apart simply by trust. In other words, he ran his business like as a he had a gas station business, and a lot of the guys that dealt with my father on a credit basis. It was right after the war, and it was all a lot of credit, and when it came time to pay, they didn't have it, and eventually my father went bankrupt. $12,000-$13,000 in debt, and that's a lot of debt in the 40s. That's a lot of money in the 40s for his labor and his gas and oil, and he lost his shirt.
Yeah.
And he continued on through life as a, you know, mechanic and lubrication man, grease monkey, they used to call him years ago. But
aside from the church, was there other community involvement on the part of your grandparents and your parents?
Well, my mother originated of the local NAACP. My mother was in the NAACP. They also after the NAACP, they organized a group called the Crescent Civic Center, which consists of my mother and Mr. Phillips and Katie Griffin and Henry Griffin. These were more or less people that were trying to more or less let the people in town know that we were involved in our community. There was very little heard of in the community about this organization, and they soon folded in the 50s.
the Crescent Civic Association?
Crescent Civic. They're they're trying to get it together again. I don't know how well they're doing. I know my sister is involved in that organization. Primarily, they're involved in the better the life of the community for the blacks, as far as housing. Of course, it's very hard to survive in Port Washington on the North Shore now, as far as buying homes, getting businesses started now. It's very, very hard. Very hard. It takes a lot of bucks in Port Washington. It takes a lot of big bucks.
What was the original membership, do you think, of the Crescent Civic Association?
Around
in the
50s? 25 or 30 people, that's all. Port Washington primarily has a very small black community anyway.
What's the approximate size?
I figure less than 1,000 blacks in Port Washington. I don't know how many people are in Port Washington, maybe 20,000?
30,000?
30,
yeah.
Well, it's still a very small number.
Yeah. How about when you were growing up? Was there a greater proportion of blacks? Or
yeah, there was more blacks then. Well, most of them died off, married, left town.
Yeah.
Well, you see, what happened was... they couldn't afford to live here. They couldn't afford to buy homes here. The rates were so high, the taxes are so high then, and still now. I think my two sisters bought homes in Port Washington, and I bought property in Port Washington. I still own property in Port Washington, but never being able to get that good buck to start, you know, and why start something that you can't finish? My aunts own property. In fact, to go back now, I think my cousins, the Griffins, are property owners still in town. My sister, who is now a Simpkins, owns property. My other sister, Charlotte, owned a home in Port Washington that she moved to Tulsa. And that there's very few property owners in Port Washington that can afford to survive. I know my cousin Helen. She has some land. Sadie Johnson, Miss Johnson, a very beautiful person. She held a lot of property in Port Washington. Ito's, Ruth Brown. But what happens is they're swallowed up in taxes. They have to sell. They have to sell. They have no choice. You can't pass properties or land off to offspring because eventually they're going to lose it. It's so hard to keep the taxes up in Port Washington. You know, even though your roots are here and you're born and raised here, the taxes flush you right out.
Yeah. Well, you know, in the 19th century, the Mill Pond was surrounded by black-owned ownership homes.
Yeah,
as
right.
early as that. But even those houses, very early on, changed hands. And I'm wondering why.
Well, I know some very good friends of the family, which weren't cousins, which is a rarity because just about everybody in Port Washington, the blacks, were related. A few black families on Sandy Hollow, I remember the King family and Charlie Bennett, they owned homes on Sandy Hollow, which is now across the street from, I forget what that area is called, Sandy Hollow Road, those development in Roger Drive, Lewis Lane, I forget what community
they
call it.
Eastern Crest?
No, below Eastern, well, before Eastern Crest, even. The King family, the Bennetts, lived on Sandy Hollow Road.
They were black families?
Yeah. And I think it was zone changes or something. I think that side of Sandy Hall Road now is considered Baxter Estates. I don't know, the taxes have changed, or Eastern Crest, whatever. I think it's either Eastern Crest or Baxter Estates changed hands, you know, zoning, and wow, the taxes shot right up on them, so they had to resulted in them moving. They couldn't afford it, you know, and that was a slow way of moving them out of the area. And, you know, when you a black man's out doing labor, and the wife is generally doing day's work. I mean, There were very few female black professionals, you know, except for day work, factory work. They didn't hold executive positions. They couldn't afford to pay the taxes in Port Washington. Where I was born, the house there was offered to my father, I think then, in the 40s, for $5,000, which he should have bought. But that was a lot of money to him. And that was owned by...
Jerry, excuse me, I'm going to cut this off because I want to turn the tape over.
Okay.
All right? This is the end of side one.
Well, the only famous, as far as I'm concerned, anybody that ever went anywhere was, well, in the 50s, my cousin Bill, he was on a championship high school basketball team. And when Bill graduated, he went to South Carolina to college. And he got on a team, a professional, a semi-pro basketball team known as the Broadway Clowns. This was semi-professional. They were like a farm club of the, Globetrotters. And he was on that team for maybe two or three years. And then I guess money, road money and stuff like that wiped him out. Famous people... we had a family full of the best comedians in the world. They never got anywhere, but they kept it in the family. We had singers, dancers. I had a cousin, Chet, who to me had the prettiest voice in the world, Chet Townsend. Uncle Will, all these guys that could do the shuffle and bunk dances and... harps, play the musical harpsichord, whatever they call them, the mouth harps.
Where did they socialize?
Mostly in somebody's backyard or on a Sunday afternoon. Sunday afternoons were more or less church days. As children, my Uncle Eddie Dumpson, who was my grandmother's brother, he was a king to me. He was strict, but every Sunday morning, they were very patriotic people back in those days, too. We had to get up on the side of my house or the side of Aunt Lillian, Uncle Eddie's house, and he would take us for a ride just about every Sunday morning. We would go down to see the famous Yankee Clipper. At that time, it was Doc. He used to come in down where the... Old Republic Grumman aircraft building was. Pan Am used to have a Yankee Clipper that came down there, and all the big shots used to come down with their big packets and stuff like that. And the greatest thrill for us was to see that Yankee Clipper taking off from Orchard Beach. That was it. The plane, to see the plane taking off was a great thing for us. The World's Fair in 1930, I guess the World's Fair was in 1940, whatever. My mother took me, 39, they took me to the World's Fair. I don't even remember. But for entertainment, we had a ball club, which was called the Eagles, Port Washington Eagles, which all my cousins played for. And they were cheered on by some of the old-timers, Howdy Dumpson and Uncle Dan and all those guys. They used to go to the ball games. And I used to sit around and hear them talk about my Uncle Rube Townsend and Howdy Dumpson and how well they played ball in the early 1900s when they had the colored all-stars. And there was one of the best ball teams in New York State. They would take anybody on. They were good. Of course, in the 50s, the 40s and 50s, we had the Eagles, very good ball players on there, Buddy Dumpson and the Losey boys, my cousin Arthur and Kenny and Dutch and Frank Miller and these guys. They played good ball. But then they were mixed then. It wasn't an all-black team then. We had, I think there was a guy on there by Mauser. John Mauser and Nick Sicker and Max D'Alessandro. These guys all played ball in the early 50s. And that was a mixed team. They was an all-black team. Back when my great uncle used to play ball, it was all-black. And they had a hell of a ball team. And on Sundays, we used to get together and jump in a car and go to an Eagles ball game, whether it was in Oyster Bay or Glencove or Roslyn. And we would go to these games on Sunday. There was no television or nothing like that. Movies were a rarity, you know. Well, I just go to movies every Saturday, but that was the entertainment of the days. Of course, we went ice skating. I was born and raised right on the water, so we did a lot of ice skating, a lot of swimming, a lot of clamming, crabbing, going after crabs, fishing on in the old mill pond, and then on Sundays we'd go down and watch the model boat races. This was it, you know. It wasn't New York City, that was the entertainment.
Picking, you got out of line. Who disciplined you?
Anybody. Black, white, I wouldn't care. If you were wrong, you were wrong. They'd put the foot to you, or there was no slap on the wrist. They'd kick you in the butt good, or put a stick to you, and then they told your parents, and you got a double dose. It was very seldom they had to do this, because you respected everybody. Everybody was Mr. and Ma'am and Mrs. You know, I see a lot of children today, they use a first name basis to people three times their age, you know. Children will call guy, "Hey Joe," and a guy's 70 years old or 60 years old. I still call people Mr. and Miss. Yeah. And that's gone. Respect to the highest has dwindled. You have so many things that could possibly bring it around. You have your militants now, your anti-whites, you have your anti-blacks, and they're more outspoken than they was in the 30s and the 40s, I guess. I never heard of the black being used against me, or it was going to be used against me because I was black. And the only time that happened to me, I was in junior high school. I guess I was in the ninth grade, and I used to do a lot of hanging out at the fire department right here across the street, Protection Engine Company, and I used to hang around there as a kid. As I grew older, I joined the American Legion Drum Corps, and we used to play in all the firemen's parades, and a lot of times they won best in line or the best marching in the drill because of a segregated bugle and drum corps. And little did I know that eventually I wanted to be a fireman. I always wanted to be a fireman. I loved the fire department. And one day I was leaving the Main Street School, and we was going down here to the pond for lunch. Maybe steal a cigarette. Those days you had to steal a cigarette. If you got caught smoking, somebody rammed it down your throat. But this friend of mine, and he's still my friend, I won't mention his name, but his father was a fireman. And I told him, I says, you know, soon we'll be in high school, and the first thing, as soon as I turn 18 years old, I'm going to join the fire department, you know. And he told me that day, he says, "Biddle, you can't get in the fire department." I said, "Hey, what do you mean I can't get in? We'll be 18. He says, "They won't let you in, Jerry." And I asked him why. And he says, "You're black, man." I mean, he didn't, you know, I loved him for this. He says, "You're black." I said, "What do you mean? So what?" He says, "Man, they ain't going to let no black guy in the fire department. I get out of here." And I said, "Why?" He said, "Man, they'll blackball you so fast." And I said, "What do you mean blackball?" He said, "Well," and he told me, "there's such thing as they have ping pong balls, and they all pick a ball, and they throw them in a hat or something like that, and if there's one black ball, you don't go." And I says, "Come on, you gotta be, I'm telling you, Jerry," says, "if you can't get in, I'll never join." Until today, he never joined. He probably never told his father this, he probably told no one about this, but it was like a little thing that he said, and that's why I'll never be a fireman. until today. I think his father's passed on now, but he still hasn't joined the fire department. And I look at him today and we speak. I respect him highly. He respects me highly. We're not, you know, we don't socialize, drink together, or party together, but I always look at him and I say, well, there's one guy, as a kid, he opened my eyes. And then,
what about the police department? Do they have the same?
The police department, no. Well, you have to pass a test. I know at one time I was going to Delahanty Police Institute, my cousin and I, to take the Nassau County Patrolman's test. And my mother at the time was working with another lady whose husband was the chief of the Sands Point Police Department. The last name was Rubens. He was at that time the chief. And he had told my mother, get your son, tell him to take the police test, and if he passes, I will see that he gets on the Sands Point Police Department. And a funny thing happened. The day I went to school, and the day I was supposed to take the test, and this one, jobs were, you know, pretty hard and hard to come by, and the guy I was working for, which was a bad mistake I made, he told me, he said, all right, you go take the test, but if you don't pass, you don't have a job. If you pass, you don't have a job. You have to wait for the police to call you. And I thought about that thing for days, and when the day came, I chickened out. I went to work instead of taking the police department test. Well, this went on, and I went into the Army. And when I came out of the service, I went to work for driving trucks. And I finally got a job with the government. I worked at the Navy base. And one day,
in
Sands Point, yeah, I worked at the Naval Training Advisor, security. I was a security guard, and then I also joined the Port Washington Auxiliary Police Department, and I was young, and in 1965, while working for the government, we were standing on a corner one day, and the firemen were coming around collecting money for the new ambulance, I think, and two of the firemen approached us, and we were standing there, and I gave him $2. My cousin John says to me, he says, what are you doing? He says, I ain't giving you guys nothing. He says, I wouldn't give you guys a dime. I said, John, it's for a fire, you know, for an ambulance. You know, your mother, sisters, brothers use the ambulance, you know. He says, well, I'll tell you something. See, you ever seen a black fireman? I said, well, no. He said, well, you ain't going to see none either. I said, well, John, this is, you know, things that have been passed on to us. But, you know, I said, you might be right. I says, he said, well, you deal with the firemen, you know them all. He says, why don't you try and join us? Well, really, I'm thinking about it, John. I said, well, when the time comes, I'm really ready, I'll try and join. He wouldn't give me any money. I gave him $2. Mm-hmm. And he told me I was stupid, blah, 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 whatever. So anyway,
Well, politically, did you and your family channel your feelings into any particular political party, or did you vote?
Well, yeah. Oh, we always voted. My grandmother was a staunch Republican, I was a Democrat up until, believe it or not, this year. I voted for Reagan. I couldn't see anything that the Democratic Party was doing. This is my own.
What would your grandmother have said if she
knew I
turned Republican? Democratic. Well, also, the fact that you were voting Democratic.
All the way.
How did she react to that?
She didn't like it. Well, no. When I told her I was voting Democratic, she said, son, never will you see a Democrat handle the area of the town of Northampton. It was just, I was, my grandfather was Republican, and the Republican Party was, more of a sophisticated party, a money party, and she told me that's the way the money's at, and you got to go Republican. And my Uncle John's Republican.
It wasn't because there's a tradition of Republicans all the way back from the Civil War being associated with Abraham Lincoln. You don't think those were her reasons?
Lincoln?
Was a Republican.
Lincoln was a Republican? I didn't know that. Lincoln, he was doing what he had to do. It was inevitable that he had to go the way he did. I don't think he really was so much behind it. The country was leaning that way to freedom for the slaves and blah, 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 whatever. Frederick Douglass and all those guys, the blacks that had finally gotten north and put people's heads together and got it straight. My political beliefs were that Democrats weren't producing anything. Harry Truman, as far as I'm concerned, was a very good president. I think I liked Harry Truman.
Yeah.
John F. Kennedy.
I like Minnie Biddle's politics. Had she heard of Booker T and the Niagara Movement? And did she?
No, I don't think they weren't really that heavy into books or politics, except what they were taught by told by their employers, the best party to vote for, and this is the way they led their lives, and working for the hides and the backs. These were most primarily Republicans, and being they were working for these people, they swayed with the Republican Party. From what I understand, is most blacks voted Republican up until the days of, I think something happened in the Texas with the Teddy Roosevelt and the Buffalo Soldiers, something where there was an incident where they locked these boys up in Texas, and this is what finally swayed blacks to go Democratic, when the Republican Party turned on these black soldiers in Texas. My mother taught me the Democratic way was the way to go. Stick with the Democrats, you can't go wrong. Well, I used to work with the Democratic Party on a lot of their campaigns. And at the time I was employed by the federal government, I was working very hard with the Democratic Party when we had a guy who was running for the Sheriff's Department. At that time, I forget his name. Dugan was running for the sheriff of Nassau County Sheriff, and I worked very hard for the party, and Dugan won. He won. And of course, when you're working for a party, there's jobs. A job came up as a sheriff. I was interviewed, passed it's more or less like a interview, personal background, blah, 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 and they told me I was qualified to become a sheriff for Nassau County. It's the greatest day of my life. Greatest day of my life, I was going to become a sheriff. And then fate struck. It was a big Democratic party over at Roosevelt, the Starlight Room at Roosevelt Field, Roosevelt Racetrack. I shook hands with Bobby Kennedy, a lot of heavy Democrats in the party, Dugan, or the heavy Democrats from Nassau and whatever. And we were greeted by Bobby Kennedy and the heavy entourage of Democrats. We went to a final meeting in the sheriff's department's office with Tom Dugan and a lot of his men, and they told me, "So, well, Mr. Biddle, you've been picked, and you're qualified, and you're now going to be employed by the sheriff's department." And I was so happy. So they said, "Now," so Tom Dugan says to me, "He says, now look, he got the 30 guys, the first 30 guys that were picked by the committee, who wanted to start on the 1st of January and 60, January of 1960, they were taking on 30 men. 15 was supposed to start the 1st of January, the other 15, the 15th of January. So I said, well, look, I'll start on the 15th. I still had to give my job notice and I had to quit. So once I got the job, I was getting a hard time at the government job, and I went down and told the chief of security how I felt about him for the last 5 years, and, you know, take this job and shove it. And that's what happened. Anyway, I told him to shove the job on the 6th of January. I told him I'm going to stay on until around the 10th, then I'm gone. He says, well, you don't tell me to take my job and shove it, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, I left the job.
Yeah.
How'd your family react?
They were very proud because I was going to be a sheriff. On the 9th of January that very year, Tom Dugan died in office. 9 days in office, he died. So I'll never forget a friend of mine coming to me. I was on duty at the Navy base that very day. It was on a Sunday. And he came up to me and he says, well, what are you going to do now? What do you mean what I'm going to do? I had the Daily News, but I didn't open it. He said, well, your buddy died. And I said, who died? He said, the sheriff. I said, what do you mean he died? He had a heart attack and he died. Well, right away, I got on the phone. I picked up paper. There it is. Tom Dugan dead, 9 days in office. I panicked. I called my local Democratic representative. I said, sir, his name was Jules Siegel. I said, Jules, what does this mean? You know, he says, Jerry, don't worry about it. You didn't quit your job yet. I said, not only did I quit it, man, I really gave this guy the second degree. I ran to it. He says, Jerry, my God, well, I don't know. Jobs is at a standstill. Wow, I was nervous. Anyway, by the time I got home, the job was kaput.
Wow.
So that was it. So I had to go and beg for my job back with the federal government, and they rehired me. Gave me different hours, but they took me back because my work record there was very good. Leading up into 1965 and my local responsibilities in this town, I've always been a clean-cut citizen. Not a militant, but a person that always speaks out when I see, if I see a wrong, I'll tell you about it. I don't care. I mean, I always felt that this was my town. My roots go back further than just about anybody's here in this town, my family blood.
Yeah.
And
Are there any verbal expressions that your family uses? This is sort of changing the subject, but just to establish some more family tradition.
My grandmother always said, when you see the sawdust, you're getting close to the mill. What it meant. I don't know, but when you see the sawdust, you're getting close to the mill. Anyway, in 1965, I decided, well, I'm going to join the fire department. And I went through the routine of trying to get in, and what happened was I really got run around. They gave me a run around, and I was starting to feel then. I said, well, hey, this is the real thing now. Everybody's backing off. The chief at that time, who I really admired and thought he was fair, I approached him, and it was, oh, well, hey, man, please, geez, not me. Let me be chief a little longer. You know, you started some other time, you know. And I was chased around to different fire captains, and finally, the final outcome was you have to have two people to fight. Please, Jerry, don't ask this of me. Please. You know, I'm a Jew, and they'll throw me right out. And I said, what do you mean throw you out? You ran. You. No, it won't work. I got one white guy, a gentleman, a young guy who was in Vietnam with my brother at the time. But he told me, he said, well, Jerry, says, I'm going to tell you, it's going to be very hard. They're going to throw me out, but I'll sign it. Anyway, I got him, and I couldn't get anybody else. And finally, eventually, they threw this guy out of the fire department. Right. So then I found out, I said, wow, it's really here. Well, I'll make no bones about it. So I squashed it. Personally, I was hurt. But I said, well, it's here. Now I know what it is.
But you don't think it's always been here.
I wasn't led to believe it because my grandmother used to tell me, you're free, you can do anything you want. I mean, I never took advantage of it. You know, I wouldn't go around saying I was one of the toughest guys in the neighborhood and I would see a white boy or beat him up or nothing like that. There was always a few racial ethics shot at us, you know, like they used to call my cousin I, Paul, the Gold Dust Twins or Bosco, which at the time was popular chocolate. But you didn't pay it any mind, you know. And I played with Polish, Italian, Jews.
But you think your parents' opportunities were limited and your grandparents'?
Yes, but not on paper. In other words, they never tried anything. I understand from my grandmother, who told me that my Uncle Wal was an original firefighter. He used to have the wagons and the horses and the canvas buckets that they used to fight fires. And in them days, they didn't look and see if it was a black guy throwing him a bucket. He was just another farmer, a guy there who was interested in saving this guy's farm.
Yeah.
So I said, well, you know, maybe this is, maybe these, and being I knew, I'd say 85% of the firemen in town, I figured, hey, they'd let me go anyway, you know. They've got to do it because in different areas there were run into this trouble. I said, well, that's not in Port Washington because it's just that not that type of town. When I tried and failed, and I saw it, and I said, the handwriting was on the wall, and I said, wow, this is it. And I backed off it. What happened, the reason it was publicized was an incident that happened in January that following year. There was a fire at the time in the projects, and I was living I had my own place down at Miss Johnson's house on 120 Harbor Road, and I, you know, when they say fire and they say in apartments, well, I run, you know, I ran up there. The firemen were going up in the trucks, and my mother and father and my brother and sister were living there, and you're going to run up there and see, number one, where the fire is. So I happened to be a family called the Harmons. Their house was on fire. And I was walking behind this fireman who thought that I was another fireman because he was running along the side of the truck and he was putting up there dropping hose. And he made a statement that hit me like a ton of bricks. And he said, we'll burn these black bastards out yet. Soon. No, he says, oh, we'll burn these black bastards out soon. I says, and he turned around. I says, huh? And he looked around. He scurried up the hill. And I stood there. I was shocked. I said, wow, this guy's got to be nuts. I mean, he's a firefighter now. His job is save. I don't care who it is. You see pictures in the paper every day of firemen saving children, old people, black, white. They're hugging them, kissing them, trying to bring life back into their bodies. You know, artificial
respiration,
everything. And they're like, and this fireman to say this, it knocked me down. Anyway, at the fire, I was standing next to my uncle. And I told my uncle, who's passed on, I says, Uncle, I says, he was a fighting son of a gun. He's from Philadelphia. And I told him what was said. And he says, where is he? I said, well, he's over there in the crowd. Where is he? Point him out. I said, I'll go over there and kick his butt. And I say, well, I don't think it wouldn't be worth it. You start a riot up here now, they're trying to fight a fire, and forget about it. And I went home that night, and I thought about it, and I says, somebody's got to hear about this. Well, my mother, who is very smart woman. She told me, she says, Jerry, she says, one thing you got to learn is new modern life and the way to do things is the power of the press. You ever heard about the power of the press? She said, well, write something to the news and let them know about it. Maybe they'll print it. And I went home that night and I wrote my first story and I took it up to Joy Brown. And it was two pages. And she read it. She says, God, Jerry, this is great. Can you back it up? I said, back it up. It happened to me, you know. I mean, back it up. It happened to me. She says, Jerry, I'm printing it word for word. And she printed it.
Is this the news? Or the
Port Washington News. The Port Washington News Reporter. I wrote it.
Well, they have two papers, the Mail and Reporter.
Well, I took it to the Port News.
That's
Port
News.
Yeah, no, at that time, Joy Brown was the editor for this, where you write letters to the editor.
Right.
She printed it. And it hit. And I'll never forget this guy coming to me. I was working at a Navy base at the time. He came up to me at lunch hour after the paper had hit because I knew it was in the paper because that Friday morning early, I went and bought a Port Washington News. In fact, that Thursday night when they put them out, I happened to be up Main Street in one of the local bars, and I went outside and I got the paper, and I left my dime. It was a dime, and I put my dime. I ran to my car, and I looked. I said, oh, God, it's here. It's here, every word, you know. And I went home, and I called my mother. I said, Ma, it's in the paper. She says, good. So what's the big thing? I said, Ma, it's going to hit tomorrow. She says, don't worry about it. The next morning, that afternoon, this fireman who worked at the Navy base came to me. He said, hey, Jerry, what the hell did you do? Why did you put that in the paper? I said, oh, this local chief, he was a chief at the time. He don't like that. You shouldn't have did that. He says, why did you say something like that? I said, well, hey, it's the truth. And I put it there. It's there. I'm here to back it up. Well, when I got home that night, I stopped by my mother, and I said, hey, Ma. She says, oh, my God. She says, you really started something. I said, why? She said, well, the Daily News called, Newsday called, New York Times called, the New York Mirror called, all these. I said, you got to be kidding. What? Somebody from
what year was this?
1965. So I says, what are they calling for? She says, they want the information. The local Long Island Corps. The local NAACP says, look, we're backing you 100%. We're right behind your back. I say, hey, wait a minute, you guys. This is me. You know, I don't need this heavy backing. Oh, you're going to need it. You don't know what you're going to run up against. And, boy, it hit.
This is the end of interview number one with Jerry Biddle on December 18th, 1980, at the Port Washington Public Library. Thank you, Jerry.